Hi, I'm Ben.
And I'm Sarah.
And you should listen to
What's New?
Nancy Drew.
Come get a clue.
Boop, boop, doo.
What's New, Nancy Drew is a weekly podcast where we recap the latest episode of the CW show, Nancy Drew.
Yeah, so put your sleuthing brain on and join us for a good time.
Hello, everyone. Screenplay Archaeology host Kira Midhead here. Before we get into today's episode, I just want to get some intro stuff out of the way. First things first, we are now part of the Fandom Lib Media Podcast Network, so I'm going to link their site down below. And that's why you would have just heard a promo for another podcast, because they're another one of the shows on the network. And as per usual, if you like the show and you'd like to know more, you can check out our social media pages on Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and even Instagram now. The show also has a Patreon if you're willing to gift money, but you don't really need to if you don't want to. And we also have a Discord server, which you can join if you want to chat with, you know, the group members there. So that link is going to be down below as well. So yeah, sit back, guys, and enjoy the show. All right, everyone. Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Screenplay Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Kira Midhead.
And once again, I'm Chloe.
Yes, and Chloe has decided to join me for a very special script, which is something that we had kind of heard about a little bit here and there, but I didn't manage to get a hold of it until relatively recently.
Wasn't there like a Bloody Disgusting article written about it, or one of those horror sites I think that interviewed the writers for?
I would assume so. I mean,
I remember seeing like a cover page.
I don't remember ever seeing the cover page, but I remember just hearing about it. And the thing you always hear is, oh, it would have been set in winter.
From what I remember of the cover page, this thing tracks exactly with its same title.
Yeah, I don't think I ever saw that personally. So we're going to be covering the sequel to the remake of Friday the 13th, which is called Friday the 13th, Camp Blood, with an extra subtitle. I won't be saying, because it's kind of a ridiculous fucking spoiler to put on the title page.
It's interesting to go through this script, because it does read like a first draft, and I had pretty low expectations of it, but was pleasantly surprised.
It's a good first draft. And so the basic, before we get into like a very, very brief background of the Friday the 13th series, the basic plot of this one, because in my early days, I always do this because in my early days, I used to get shit for not putting like a synopsis at the beginning. And it's that it's basically after like, there's like a brief interlude in winter at the beginning, but the bulk of the movie is a new camp is opening up where Camp Crystal Lake used to be, which was abandoned in the remake. And Jason basically shows up and is like, I don't want these people here, and just starts killing everybody. And I'm going to leave it at that for now. Now, I will give my very, very quick sort of view of the series. I actually really like the first six on differing levels. I think they're all pretty fun. I think 4 and 6 are probably the best, but I do like 2 and 3. And the first movie, surprisingly compared to when I first got into them, gets a lot more shit now than it did then, but I still like that movie. And I like 2 and 5, even though 5 is stupid and doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That one still has the entertainment value to it. And after 6 is where it kind of starts falling apart, because I think 7 is okay at best. Takes Manhattan is terrible. I do like Jason Goes to Hell, even if it doesn't fit in the series at all. Jason X I don't like. Freddy vs. Jason I enjoy. And then the remake, well, we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail as we go. So yeah, your cliff notes.
So yeah, part one, I consider a classic. I feel like whenever I see certain people on the internet talk about it now, they have to like put an asterisk next to their enjoyment of it. Like, oh, but it's slow. Like, not really, other than the, you know, the 2 minute coffee scene. Is it the most artistically made slasher film? No, but it, you know, accomplishes what it sets out to do. And it's still fun and entertaining. And then I think the second movie is even a stronger film because it actually does have tighter pacing in editing and in cinematography and lighting. I think it's a little stronger. And then part three is, you know, really fun. Unfortunately, I've yet to get the chance to, like, go to a 3D screening. Founder might be my favorite. It's tied with part six. Part five, it grows on me every time I watch it just because of how bad and insane it is.
Yeah.
And then part six, like I said, it might be tied for my favorite. It's always hard to say because I think it alternates between four and six, maybe even two. And managed to, you know, bring a new, you know, burst of energy to the series. The only part now that I kind of, like, look back at the presentation is Alice Cooper's involvement, but that's a story for another day. And the music that he did is still good. Part seven is one that I will defend, because unfortunately, like, we can only see, like, the work print cut, for the theatrical cut even, which, out of all the movies, is the most butchered.
That is true.
But it has, like, if you watch the work print cut, it has some of the best deaths. My particular favorite being the guy who gets his, like, head crushed. When I met Kane Hodder, that was, like, the thing that I had him do to me, was, like, grabbing the top and bottom of my head. And a year later, I met John Carl Beekler and showed him that. And, he said, why does Kane look like he's constipated? And a year after that, I meet CJ Graham and Steve Dash, and I'm telling them, showing, you know, relating that to CJ Graham. Goes, yep, Kane always looks like he's taking a dump. Part eight is, like, the biggest missed opportunity in the series. And, yeah, some of that comes down to budget. But it really does have annoying characters. Part nine is bonkers, and I love it. That's another fun topic to go into. Jason X has grown on me. That I went through rewrites that, you know... God damn it, I forgot what I was about to say. Like, but yeah, like, some of the death scenes I know were, like, toned down from what they were supposed to be initially. Like, the, there's, like, the scene with a couple having, like, their weird kinky sex, and then, like, Jason basically knocks on the door, the guy goes up, and he gets stabbed, and the blood splurts onto the girl. And originally, it was supposed to be a joke on, like, the automatic doors in spaceships.
Oh.
Where, like, Jason would fuck with the wiring, and it would cause the door to crush the guy. But either way, I'm like, okay, well, that was clearly a missed opportunity, but it does have head freezing and smashing. That's fun. But, like, about it, there are things I don't like about it.
I mainly just think the movie has maybe two jokes in it, and they get repeated so much it gets old by the time the movie's over.
Yeah, yeah. The idea of a girl also being cryogenically frozen with Jason, so you have another, like, artifact in the past. Other than a couple of jokes, they don't really play up, like, the fact that she could be, like, an OG, like, survival girl. But... okay, and then, Freddy vs. Jason, it's a complicated movie to talk about, but you have to think about the fact that they spent 10 years in development hell. And having looked at the other scripts that were, commissioned, we got the best one. Point is that Freddy doesn't get as much action as initially intended.
Yeah, that's...
after that, in terms of what we've gotten over the years, the other script, Nick Antosca draft is incredibly strong.
Yeah, it just needed some cleaning up in a few places.
Well, that's it. The Guzikowski draft, I'm kind of glad. I'm glad it got canceled at the last minute.
Yeah, because it was three movies crammed into one. Yeah, so... do we talk about the remake now?
Yeah.
I'll go first because I want to say right off the bat, whatever problems I have with the movie, I feel like because it's Shannon and Swift writing it after Freddy versus Jason, I feel like because they got a lot of shit over how Jason was handled in that movie in Freddy versus Jason. So I feel like they just, like, their number one goal was don't do that this time. And so they just made Jason. It's one of the best Jasons in all the movies. Like, Derek Mears is always great.
I sort of feel like it's him with Halloween Resurrection, where it's like, wow, I don't really like this movie, but I'll watch it for, like, Derek Mears, or I'll watch it for Brad Lurie.
And, like, the whole Hunter Jason thing was really cool. The arrow death is cool. I feel like they had some interesting ideas that they should have kept in the movie, like him standing on the shore until the girl drowns. I thought that would have been cool.
Yeah. mixed bag of a movie because, like, I have friends who are like, you know what? I actually really like this one. And I'm like, or I've seen, like, other, I think some people are, like, you know, being contrarian who will just say that they like it or that they think it's the best one. And I'm like, really?
It's a mixed bag because Jason's really good. Some of the characters are good. There's some good kills. But, like, so much of that movie is, like, a fucking cartoon, and it's so obsessed with, like, weed jokes.
And then, like, there's, like, the jock character who's really annoying.
Oh, Trent?
It's always surprising that, like, I know some people who just love the movie or, like, think it's one of the best ones. I wish I was there. I wish I could be on that level. I'm just not. But I will admit it's probably still a better watch than, like, Nightmare on Elm Street remake.
Yeah, that movie's just kind of bland. So yeah, this script, Friday the 13th, Camp Blood, not saying the subtitle, written by Damian Shannon and Mark Swift. But yeah, it's dated November 19th, 2009. I suppose we should just jump right into it.
Well, do we know why this thing wasn't really produced?
It was only like a month later that they announced that it was on hold. Basically, what I've heard is, I remember hearing years ago that it was, I think it was one of the Platinum Dunes guys was talking about how it was a very specific set of circumstances that allowed them to make the remake to get New Line and Paramount to work together. And that apparently getting that to happen again was just very, very difficult. It opens with the New Line and Paramount logos freezing over in 3D. And so this script really emphasizes the 3D effects.
A little more than the Antosca draft.
I would say way more, because the Antosca draft maybe mentions it like 2-3 times. This does it like at least twice as much.
Okay.
And there's even scenes where they don't specifically say it's 3D, but it's very clearly described like it would be one. And so, you know, we go to Crystal Lake in winter, where Sheriff Hal and Deputy Bobby, and I even...
I'm not remembering their names.
Yeah, they don't even get last names.
They don't even show up.
No, they don't. Yeah, they're walking up to a cabin in the woods to seal the door with a red fumigation sticker, talking about how, oh, somebody has bought up the land around the lake. They're planning to reopen the camp. Hal thinks it's a bad idea. Somebody killed those kids last summer. And Bobby says, oh, yeah, Clay Miller did it, and he's gone on the run since then. So if you want to know what happened to Winchester, that's what happened.
Yeah, and if you're wondering what actually happened to Clay, I don't know, it sparked like a whole Paul part.
He's on the run, apparently, because they think he did it, which makes no sense.
There is a reveal in a few minutes on what happened to the other character, but no, there's no payoff to the whole Clay character.
No, none at all. And so Hal, like, fucks with Bobby a little bit, saying, hey, I can leave you here, and then they both leave. They leave the movie. So we then go to teenagers Tim, Ed, Russell, and Polly, who are driving in a van, and the last...
I'm not remembering their names.
Oh, no, they're intro bait. And the latter two already drinking vodka. And the others are unhappy because it's supposed to be a guy's trip. And so they head to the cabin from before. Tim just cuts the sticker open with his keys. And Tim and Ed soon leave to go play hockey on the frozen lake, while Russell and Polly stay behind for drinking games and sex, which pisses off Tim because he knows Russell's going to pass out and he's going to have to drive the return trip as well. I'm like, what a little bitch.
Yeah, and also,
But so Tim trips on a wire in the woods, which rings a bell down in an underground tunnel next to a preserved head of Mrs. Voorhees, and it says, back where she belongs. And I'm like, hold on, if I'm remembering the remake right, he had her head in the hole in the wall in the cabin.
Oh, yeah, that was the other thing. I did not bother to watch the remake.
I didn't either, because there's not that much to remember from it.
Yeah, I'm like, okay, I'll just remember the annoyance.
And so a dark figure walks by, grabbing a hockey mask. And I remember the underground tunnels being kind of controversial with that movie. I don't think they're that bad. Also, I remember Jason running being controversial, which is just brain dead because he runs in like half the movies.
Yeah, he can pick up speed if he needs to.
And then by Jason Takes Manhattan, he just teleports. All right, so Tim and Ed, they're playing hockey on the lake. when Ed spots the corpse of Whitney Miller floating by under the ice, so there she goes. And Tim then notices Jason in the hockey mask, watching them from the shore, staring at them. Not knowing what's going on, they tried to talk to him, going like, hey man, we didn't bring an extra stick or anything. And Jason just follows them out onto the ice and is like, and it's like, guys, something we've never seen before. Jason walks onto Crystal Lake. And I'm like, it's not that big of a deal. Jason walks in every movie.
He's a guy who's always standing and walking.
Okay, but okay, so Tim and Ed flee, but Ed trips and falls. Jason stabs him through the back, straight down through the ice in 3D. And Tim just barely manages to change into his boots and escape, slipping down a ridge and getting clipped in the shoulder by Jason's machete. And Tim flees back to the cabin. Polly and Russell are passed out and the door is locked, so Tim hides on the roof. But he slips off, almost gets an icicle in the face, catching it just in time before Jason shows up, stomps it straight into his eye. And I'm like, wow, that's a solid icicle. And Polly wakes up soon after, goes to restart the fire. And this is a cool moment where she wipes the condensation off the window and Jason is standing right there.
Yeah, I've always wanted to like do that for a movie, you know, for years with that sort of slasher reveal.
And so Polly screams, waking Russell as Jason smashes the window. And this is ridiculous. Shards go into her mouth and out the back of her head in 3D, killing her. Like, so Jason is just super, it's like super powered now. And Jason climbs in through the broken window, chops Russell in half, fading to the title screen, which is just Friday the 13th, Camp Blood, without the spoiler. So we cut to 4 months later, now summer. So there goes your Jason Winter setting, guys. I hope your obsession with that was worth the wait.
Does that mean the script takes place in, that the opening took place in like, what, February?
I guess. Must be one damn cold winter in New Jersey.
I don't know what winters are like in New Jersey.
Yeah, I don't know either. Olivia, who is going to be working as a camp counselor, is dropped off by her friend Sarah, and we get the impression that she has trouble at home that she's running from, and she soon meets Rex, a hard-ass who's been put in charge of the counselors, and sends her into Millie's Tavern to retrieve another counselor named Angelo, who's a bit of a dumbass.
Oh, I'm Angelo!
He seems like a late 2000s version of like an early Travolta character, specifically described as wearing Ed Hardy. And like, I think I knew this guy. And they're warned by the bartender and the local drunk about the camp. And the last guy to Wagon finally shows up. And it turns out to be this tough guy named Benny that Olivia has a history with that they don't quite expand on yet. And so they're going to Camp Crystal Lake. And on the way there, we find out that Rex's favorite insult is gooch, that he keeps calling Angelo for some reason.
I think Marshall Bell from Nightmare on Elm Street
2. Oh, Jesus. No one smacks Rex's ass with a towel, though.
Yeah, but like that coach, he is flaming. Just sit back and relax there, gooch.
It turns into a running joke, too. Yeah, Vorzazzle.
So at the camp, we get introduced to our hippie guy.
We first meet Tommy, who has arrived in a pickup truck, and it's implied to have, like, significant stuff in the truck bed. Now, if you know the Friday the 13th movies, you know where they're going here. I'm gonna hold off on it just for the sake of going how the script goes. But yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, if you know your Friday the 13th, you're going to be watching this movie going, aha. And from there, we meet the camp's owner, who's this hippie burnout named Jerry.
And his noble wife named Christy. Oh boy, the things we do with her later.
Yes, and she's much less enthusiastic about the camp idea. And I love how they put, like, in the script, like, oh yeah, he might be considered lightly annoying, as if they're, like, acknowledging the criticism of Trent.
But also they set up here the kitten motif.
And Tommy arrives, and Jerry has lead counselors Miles and Val take him to his cabin. And we find out that these two, they had sort of a fling last summer, and she's being very obsessive and flirty about it, to the point where she says, oh, if you want to put something in my ass, you're welcome.
Very weird, because you contract this couple with Benny and Olivia, where Benny is like, obviously, like, Benny is a monster. But then, in the opposite role here, you have Val, who is being almost stalkerish.
Yeah, yeah.
And the script plays it up like a joke, and I just have to wonder, is it because of our Norman society, where we kind of, like, somehow work as, like, female stalkers as being, like, funny or cute?
Yeah, unfortunately, that could be it.
I know that, like, Damian Shannon and Mark Swift had, like, a script, like, they were going to adapt some, like, female comic book character at one point, but, like, producers or funders like, oh, well, there's no market for that. So, like, I know that they've tried having, like, female-centric, like, scripts or whatever, but, like, I don't know. It's just, I don't know, it's kind of telling. Then again, this is Platinum Dunes we're talking about.
Your tits are stupendous. Yeah, and so they run into Rex and the rest of the counselors as they arrive. And we then meet Camp Cook Carl, a burly ex-Marine, as he arrives with supplies, including alcohol. And Jerry, like, isn't happy about that, but Carl is like, yeah, I mean, if I don't have alcohol, I might just go on a killing spree. Ha ha ha.
Well, you should mention that because, like, guess what? Yeah, any other job, you could fire for saying that.
Yeah. No, but this guy's pretty funny. Do you think that they would have, like, tried to get Kane Hodder for this?
Yeah, I could see that. I was also thinking, even though he's only written to be in his, like, what, 40s, I was also thinking of Tom Savini.
Yeah, you gotta change his name to Sex Machine, then. Shoot Jason with his dick gun. Yeah. And so they all split off to, like, check into their cabins, and Tommy is evasive when Miles asks him why he signed up. And Olivia, we get a call back to the original movie where Olivia spots a snake in the girl's cabin, and Tommy manages to trap it in the pillowcase, saying he'll release it since he knows it's a harmless species as he knows the area. Like, so that's an interesting deviation from the original scene. And so they hear the camp bell ringing and head to the meeting. And Jason hears as well down in the tunnels, awakening and walking off. So he didn't hear any of this restoration of the cabins or anything, but he hears the bell.
The bell even just, like, accidentally ring a couple of times when it's all being set up.
Yeah. So at the meeting, Christy, she starts making eyes at Angelo.
One thing I like about the character Miles, like myself, is an Eagle Scout.
Oh, yeah. But they learn to their chagrin at the meeting that Jerry has set up the place as a green vegetarian camp and apparently didn't bother telling anybody when he hired them. And Olivia asks him about why it's called Camp Blood. And he tells the story of Jason drowning and Pamela Voorhees going crazy and killing people. So we get more backstory here as opposed to the remake where you literally just get, what, 2 minutes?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
And so he then has them split into groups with Miles, Val, and Tommy going to the rec room where he has them practice CPR on the practice dummy. And I like this thing where, is it Miles who says that, like, oh, chest compressions could cause trauma on a child? So you're not supposed to do it. And he's like, I better go look that up. So he leaves. That tells you exactly that they were actually kind of up to date with that. Because when I was learning about CPR in middle school, this would have been eighth grade, 2006. So we were still learning chest compressions as part of it.
I would have been like 12 years old in 2008. And that's when the directions became different.
But yeah, and then Val does her thing. She starts making out with the CPR dummy, and she sucks its nipple. She doesn't even care that, like, some strange dude is there in the room.
Yeah, I should also mention one of my favorite lines is when Rex is, you know, saying that there will be no smoking, no alcohol, no drugs of any kind, and Jerry interrupts with saying, "For the record, I'm legalization of marijuana, but this one's about the children and the insurance company."
Oh, he keeps bringing up the insurance company. It's like a running gag. And so the rest of them, they go with Rex to clean out old cabins, which you think this close to opening up they would have done by now. But they're cleaning out the old Voorhees cabin, and this is where we get the idea. This is where we get the information that Benny is Olivia's ex who has followed her out here. Like, this is where they finally, like, you know, say that.
Yeah, I like this. Obviously, like, if there were a rewrite, they could play that out more.
Yeah, and so they go into... one thing I wish they didn't do is when he first shows up, he goes like, oh, we're going to learn soon that he is truly dangerous. I'm like, yeah, thank you for spoiling the movie. Yeah, but okay, and so she finds a trap door leading to the root cellar, where she comes across a Voorhees family photo album, and we have Pamela's husband Elias is shown wearing a big belt buckle, and Jason's face is consistently almost comically obscured in every picture.
Oh, if you're wondering about the whole Elias mystery, you can solve it in 2 pages.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we get a fake-out jump scare of Angelo yelling boo, and then Olivia notices something like a rug partly buried in the dirt, goes for a shovel to dig it out. And so while working on survival kits with Miles and Val, they talk about flints. It's like, we're giving them rocks? That was pretty funny. It's like, nah, man, I'm an Eagle Scout. You can strike this, make a spark. But Tommy notices that he notices Rex run up to Jerry and call him away. And it turns out the rug was wrapped around unidentifiable bits of bone in a shallow grave. And Rex wants to call the cops, but Jerry convinces him to keep quiet because, oh, the insurance company.
You call the cops later and some are already done with and the kids are home, eventually parents will find out about it.
So, outside, Jason is watching his childhood home and has a flashback to his parents discussing how they can't care for him at the camp. You know, he needs special care. And then Pamela, and I like this depiction of Elias because it shows him as a guy who actually genuinely cares about his son. And then Pamela just bashes him over the head with a shovel and kills him, wraps him in the rug, and buries him in the cellar.
For some reason, the first thing I thought when reading this scene was of Deep Red.
The shovel makes me think of the ending of Psycho, too.
That too.
And as they leave the cabin, Olivia gets a glimpse of Jason watching from the woods, but he disappears before she can get a good look. And so Angelo tries to offer Val some wine, but gets rebuffed. He's like, man, I can't even get laid with her.
So under 21, Dick.
Yeah, that too. And that night at dinner, Olivia tries to come on to Tommy, but he brushes her off. And so we go later at the campfire where Jerry is singing Night Moves. And all the counselors, apart from Angelo, have gathered. And Rex goes to look for him while Olivia sneaks off to get away from Benny. And so Tommy follows her, saying she shouldn't wander in the woods alone. And they talk with Olivia, saying she used to live with Benny. And they don't ever specify what exactly went on, but it's made pretty clear that it was an abusive relationship. And they come across a deer carcass, with Tommy saying they run without thinking, and people usually aren't any different. Running isn't the answer, just don't panic and try to think. A little on the nose with the theming, but...
First draft.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a Friday the 13th movie. It's surprising there's any theming at all.
Yeah, hey, it's still better than Mother is God in the Eyes of a Child.
Oh, there you go. Oh, yeah, so Angela, who is drinking his wine in one of the kids' cabins, sees Rex coming and hides under a bed. Rex enters the cabin and turns around, coming face to face with Jason, who smashes him in the face with a lantern, cutting him and setting him on fire. And Angela, who it turns out was one cabin away and has no idea what happened, runs forward and sits down at the fire where Tommy and Olivia have already returned. So you have a jealous Benny looking on at them. Val has placed her hand on Miles' knee awkwardly as Jerry finishes up his performance. So Jason put out the fire. Is that what we're meant to think? Or it wasn't that big of a fire. And next day, no one can find Rex, and Jerry starts to worry. Benny once again tries to get close to Olivia and says she can't run away from him because he'll just keep coming. Ugh.
Obviously, I want to see this thing expanded. I would love to see this thing expanded upon in a rewrite, but, like, yeah, I love that line.
Yeah, and she then runs into Tommy again, who gives her some advice about poison oak, before Val shows up to take them to the camp's zip line. And on...
There's a bit of a weird the Adam apples on hookers line.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, she is from Brooklyn, and I can see that being a thing. And so we get another weird scene from Val where she talks about how, oh, he's Miles, he's usually so stoic, but you get some chocolatinis in him and he loosens right up. And I'm like, oh, you plied him with alcohol. And so Jerry tries to demonstrate the zip line, but he isn't clipped in properly, so he ends up hanging upside down before falling out and breaking his leg. He's like, no ambulance, no insurance company. So he has Tommy drive him to the clinic. who apparently he rides in the flatbed and somehow is like, doesn't notice the special stuff Tommy has in the back.
Yeah, the whole, the biggest, okay, you need to fix this in a rewrite element is Jerry having to being out of the picture for a little bit and then coming back. Because the way that they explain how he gets back kind of takes away from like a bit of the menace factor of being out at Camp Crystal Lake once you know what I mean when we get there.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So I'll bring that up once we get there.
But no, the zip line scene is pretty funny. And so Olivia tags along to avoid Benny. Carl and Christy are left in charge. They couldn't care less. So the counselors just party and play around in the lake. And so in town, it turns out that Jerry is going to be at the clinic for a while getting his leg reset. So Tommy and Olivia decide to get something to eat away from camp. Benny tries to get beer off of Carl. This scene's actually really funny. Who overcharges him for him and he adds an asshole tax on top. That's one thing I'll say about this script. The jokes are actually pretty funny, unlike the remake, where it's just the same two jokes over and over again.
Yes, yeah. Or, God, what was the joke that always makes me cringe is the guy who's also in Final Destination 5. He's like, damn, I can't get any signal out here. Setting up like with his record label, and like the white girl asks him, oh, what type of music, rap? And he goes, what? A black man can't listen to Usher? Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. What kind of music? Rap.
I want to be reincarnated as the button on the back of her shorts.
God damn it, I hate that.
All right, and Val tries to flirt with Benny to make Miles jealous. And I love how even Benny is like, wow, that chick's crazy. And Angelo finally asks what the deal is, and Miles is like, oh yeah, we hooked up once. But, you know, I didn't really feel anything between us. I wanted there to be that spark, you know? And Angela's like, oh, yeah, I get it. You banged her with your beer goggles on. You regret it the next day.
Oh, sorry for you. Hey, don't call me that.
And so Angelo mocks Benny about Olivia before Christy walks up to him in a bikini, openly flirting with him and offering him a beer. So, yeah, that's a subplot.
This is one of the weirdest, like, sex scenes. This would have been the weirdest of all sex scenes.
Yeah.
The Tosca script here is Nurse Nicole flirting with like the head counselor guy.
Oh, they got a strip go fish.
That is tame compared to this.
Well, that was just random. This is just like a subplot.
True, but both scripts have like a male flirting with the counselor scene.
Yeah. And so we then see Jason watching the counselors from the woods near the lake and flashes back to when he drowned and the counselors at the old camp didn't notice. And we then get a glimpse into the mind of Jason where the sounds of lakeside fun intermingle with the sights and sounds of sex and death. And the sound fades back to normal and the key, 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 ma, ma, ma music begins to play. That's a cool little moment.
Yeah, I love the flashback.
And after getting advice from Carl to not worry about Miles but focus on herself, he was really just trying to get laid, so that's weird. Val heads out to the zip line. She prepares for it correctly, only for Jason to appear at the end and slice her in half, her innards splattering on the platform.
I love that.
Yep. Bye, Val.
I'm getting reminded of the opening of Wrong Turn 2, actually.
Oh, yeah, there's a line I forgot to write down where after Jerry gets taken off in the truck, she turns to Miles in front of everybody and says, hey, you want to wear my coochie like an oxygen mask?
Well, there's your opening bit.
And so back in town at Millie's Tavern, Olivia and Tommy are eating, pub, whatever, discussing the bones in the basement, and Olivia thinks it was Jason's father as she recognized the belt buckle. And Tommy tells her about the killings the previous summer and how the locals think Jason somehow survived and comes back for revenge. And Olivia mentions the man she thought she saw, and Tommy is like, okay, we should head back. And so, meanwhile, Jason is inside his old home, looking at his father's bones. Surprising amount of character moments for Jason in this. When he notices that the mess hall is lit up. Carl is now cooking whatever he feels like, and has started a party. He's even taken down the divider between the kitchen and the dining area. And they're all having fun, except for Benny, who was drinking a lot. And this is where Christy invites Angela over to her cabin, and licks his ear. Ugh. And in the truck on their way back, Tommy suggests to Olivia that they tell someone about the guy she saw, just in case. And back at the mess hall, Carl puts on a mime show where he acts like he's getting raped in prison, and Penny walks out, leaving Miles alone, who's the only one laughing.
Do you want to recreate the flirting scene here between Angelo and Christy? I'll play Christy.
Which page?
Starts on page 56.
Okay, let me get there. Okay, so it's Jerry's cabin, night. Christy and Angelo are slow dancing in the living room of her cabin. She's got a glass of red wine in one hand and Angelo's ass in the other. Mrs. Mullen?
Yes.
Angelo nods. He forgot. She turns him with a sly smile. Should say turns to him? What about your husband, Christy?
Mr. Mullen and I have an understanding. He understands that I'm a sexual being and I that he's not here.
Angelo smiles as she starts to unbutton his shirt. But what if...
I'm his ride home and he hasn't called yet. Relax. Let Mama take care of everything.
She puts her glass of wine to his lips. Mmm.
That's a good boy. Mama likes that now. You want Mama to show you her
face? I forgot about this. Now Angelo is weirded out.
He's weirded out, but he still goes with it.
Yeah, he's desperate, apparently. He was hitting on the weird chick. And so they're interrupted by Tommy and Olivia banging on the door, who tried to tell her what Olivia saw, but she just brushes them off. And they soon arrive at the mess hall, where a drunken Carl is regaling Miles with his argument as to why they should allow gays in the military. He's got, like, his arm around him.
Yeah. That's why the gays try to be allowed to serve. It's the worst that happens. Look at my dish and shower. Let me tell you. Welcome back,
kitty. They get told that everyone's wandered off by now and that Val hasn't been seen since they were by the lake. And Miles agrees to go searching for her with them, but Carl stays behind, thinking it's a prank. Okay, the three searchers check Val and Olivia's cabin, and all her stuff is there, including her smashed phone. So Jason was considerate enough to put her stuff back? Meanwhile, someone watches them while a mysterious POV enters Christie's cabin, following a trail of Angelo's clothes up the stairs. Tommy, Olivia, and Miles go to check the children's cabin and notice the lights are off, where they find the scorched mattress where Rex was killed, along with a blood stain nearby. Tommy knows something is up, tells him to stay behind, lock the door, and wait. And so we go back to the POV inside Jerry and Christie's cabin, where it walks up to the open bedroom door and sees Christy and Angelo just banging. And we see that it's not Jason, but Jerry, who made it back that night after all. He backs out of the room on crutches.
Let's see if we can recreate that one.
Oh, no. It starts at the bottom of page 60.
Oh, wait, there's no dialogue with them yet.
Yeah, there's no dialogue. Oh my god. She's into Japanese Steam games. But okay, and Tommy arrives at the parking lot, grabbing his backpack from the truck, along with some homemade dynamite he was keeping in a box in the truck bed. He then notices that wires have been pulled from every car, disabling them. I like that, because usually in these movies, the cars just don't work for no reason.
Reminds me more of like Michael in Halloween 2 at the hospital.
Yeah. Like, I mean, in part 5, where there's two random guys in the car. Okay, so back at the children's cabin, there's a banging on the door, which turns out to be a very drunk Benny, demanding to be let in. They unlock the door, and he gets aggressive, yelling at Olivia and shoving her, and knocking Miles out cold with one hit when he tries to intervene.
One punch, man.
Yes. Olivia kicks him in the balls and runs for it, but he catches up to her, slams her into a tree, and he's about to just, you know, rape the shit out of her. When a shadow is cast over Olivia, and he ducks just in time to avoid getting a machete planted in his head by Jason. And okay, so Benny runs for it, gets caught in barbed wire around his feet and face, and we're going to have to read this scene. I want to do the dialogue on this one, so.
Interior woods, night, Benny runs to the woods, looking over his shoulder. Where is he? Running as fast as his feet will carry him. Out of breath, looks back and...
Hey!
He ran right into a bolt tangle of barbed wire stretched between the dotted posts. Benny tries to move rusty barbs hooked into his skin.
Gorg! Help! Help me!
Benny turns his head an inch, a metal strand right across his face. Spike pulled his lip like a caught fish, screamed out in pain. Jason walks behind him slowly, and Benny knows he's there.
No, please, don't kill me.
Jason comes closer.
I'll do anything, please.
Ears swing down Benny's face. He's breaking down, crying. Toughness is gone. He quivers, afraid and alone. And he completely punks out as Jason comes right up to him.
I'll suck your dick.
Pull the barbed wire around Benny's face tight. Multiple rusty strands dig deep into his face. Blood drips from a puncture on his open eyes and mouth. He tries to scream, but Orm can only manage a hideous gurgle. Harder. Benny's head comes apart in sections, flying at us in horribly gratuitous, grotesque 3D. But come on, you deserve it.
It's that scene from the end of Mandy. I'll blow you, man. And then Nick Cage does the Friday the 13th 3D head crush on him.
Yeah, and it's also funny considering that, like, I ended up watching some lives and prepping for it, like, Crystal Lake and that.
Yeah. No, I'd forgotten about that line when I was rereading it. I had to stop reading for like 5 straight minutes because I was laughing so hard. And a gunshot rings out as Tommy fires at Jason and misses, pursuing him into the woods before he disappears.
Like the shot had hit Benny's dead dick.
Yeah. Like, Jason gets pissed off by sex enough as it is. Offering to blow him just makes him more angry. And so he reconvenes with Miles and Olivia, and they set off into the camp. And so back at Jerry's cabin, Christy comes downstairs and runs into Jerry, who says he knows about Angelo and isn't mad. Where do you want to start reading this?
Start at the beginning, my man.
Okay, so I'll be Jerry, I guess. Interior, Jerry's cabin, staircase, night. Christy is...
This is going to have to be Angelo.
I guess I'll double duty as Angelo. Christy is walking downstairs.
You didn't hear that? It was like firecracker.
But when she gets downstairs, she sees Jerry sitting on the couch, leg in a cast, crutches next to him. He's got a glass of wine in his hand. Christy's eyes go wide, freezes in her tracks. Actually, I did call, kitten. Had to take a cab.
Reception around here. Oh, look at you. Are you okay?
Been kind of a rough day. Why don't you both come down?
Christy's face goes white.
I know you're up there, son. Come on down. I'm not angry. We're all adults here. Christy shuts her eyes and starts coming down the stairs. Angelo follows her, wearing a pink silky woman's robe with flowers on it. He reaches for his clothes on the stairs. Oh, sorry. Those are my clothes. I'll just... No, don't go. Please, sit down. And by all means, finish the wine that you opened. It's a very expensive bottle. Jerry hands him a glass. Angelo is bugging out, not sure what to do.
Baby, I was just gonna say...
Honey, please. I'm in the middle of a toast. To Angelo. To summer camp, the time of your life. Jerry begins to drink. Angelo looks deeply uncomfortable, does the same, downing the whole glass. Christy's eyes suddenly see an open box on the table, inside her keepsakes. We see a faded bandana and other rock and roll leftovers. There's also a sheet of paper with a dozen smiley faces on it in neat rows.
Oh shit, Jerry, you asshole. Did you just slip him some acid?
Angelo's eyes go wide. Me? I'm the asshole? You're the slut who played Dirty Kitty with an 18-year-old while I was in the hospital with my leg in 3 pieces? How could you? Acid?
Are you insane? I thought you gave that all up.
And I thought you gave up being a whore. I don't do drugs. Angelo staggers to the door, pushes over a lamp, and stumbles out of the cabin as they continue the fight. Yeah. And so Tommy, Miles, and Olivia walk over to where Benny's corpse is, and Tommy tells them that the cars have been disabled and the phones have been knocked out, and he doesn't recommend walking into town as these are his woods. He pulls a flashlight out of his bag, and Olivia realizes he knows something. And Tommy says he didn't know for sure what would happen, but he came here to get Jason for killing his family. And this is where we find out, through flashback, that Tommy is Tommy Jarvis, you know, the character from 4, 5, and 6. And I like that there's not a line where he goes, "My name is Tommy Jarvis." And so we get a flashback where we learn his family rented the lake house for the summer.
Yeah, in like part four.
Yes, and we see his sister Trish from part four help him hide on the window ledge before getting killed off screen. And Tommy falls to the ground when a bloody baghead Jason appears at the window, so they remember that he got the hockey mask in the reboot.
This is also the flashback thing he's kind of reminding me of, like, part three.
Yeah, a little bit. And he comes across his wounded mother outside who tells him to run, and he does, but not before seeing Jason kill her. And I like this because the movie never fucking addresses what happens to his mother, the final chapter. And even the deleted scene that kind of does, like, it only kind of does.
It's more of a reference to kind of a Josito in this commentary track that he's kind of copying, like, one of the kills from the Prowler with, like, the eyes rolled back.
Back in the present, he tells his companions that he was in an institution for a while, but is tired of running and wants to bring the fight to Jason, and they set off into camp, and I got another, like, huge laugh here, Miles saying, first goddamn week of summer.
Also, the, maybe we got, this is insane. Olivia, maybe we shouldn't use that word, and it's going to remind you of the kid from Barbie saying, yo, reality challenge to woman. Okay. Next scene of Jerry and Chris.
Oh, we have to do the whole thing?
Yes, because it's like my favorite part of the whole scene.
Oh, really? Okay, so. Interior, Jerry's cabin, night. Jerry and Christy in the final throes of a fight. Get the hell out. This is my camp. This is my dream. Christy nods, pissed and hurt, and heads for the door. And take that piece of shit Jersey meathead with you.
I'll just take him straight to the authorities and tell them what to do. You and your stupid camp are done.
Christy leaves, slams the cabin door behind her. Jerry sees the volcano about to explode. He looks to a framed picture on the wall. He and a very young Christy in happier days. Jerry has a huge mustache, playing his bass guitar high on his chest. Fuck! And Jerry smashes at the picture with his crutch. It smashes and falls. He brings out his prescription bottle, downs a few more pills. And it ends on a kind of touching moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then that's what separates Jerry from Trent, is that he gets humanizing moments.
Yeah. Has he explained yet how he came back?
He said he got a ride or something. He explained...
No, I got a cab, which begs the question that it means it's relatively easy to get to Camp Crystal Lake. Yeah, but the town that Camp Crystal Lake is in is large enough that it has a taxi service.
The Crystal Lake taxi service.
Yeah, so that begs a lot of questions. It kind of reminds me of how Victor Miller said, like, one of his, one of the scenes that's not his from his script is the scene where the cop comes in on the motorbike.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, sit on, Tonto.
Yeah, that's what...
But that scene kind of distracts from the whole point, which is that it should be hard for anybody to get the Cram Crystal Lake out there, but the fact that you have a cop who's able to easily ride in on his motorbike kind of disrupts the atmosphere. And so having the whole Jerry and how he gets from point A to point B thing raises a lot of questions that, again, you can solve in a rewrite.
Just have Tommy and Olivia pick him up. Like, I'm like, yeah, he's going to be there for a while. Why are you just fucking leaving him in town? That's a little weird.
Yeah. Well, they left him in town, presumably, because Tommy was like, okay, we need to get back to, but there's that different delayed to Jerry. So, presumably, they were just going to drop him off there and fuck around and go back without him. So, again, this is all first draft. This is all stuff that would be easily solved in a rewrite.
Yeah, and it wouldn't even need to be a big rewrite, because this is actually a strong first draft. All right, and so, yes, Christy heads over to Angelo's cabin and goes to tend to him while he lies in bed. She pulls back the sheet, finding only pillows and the hockey mask arranged to look like someone is sleeping there. Oh, the classic prisoner bed trick from Silent Hill 4.
Yeah. Oh, I was also going to say, the whole, Jerry's foreshadowed earlier with like the cover of like one of his albums, Cat and Fighting Dragon.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
For whatever reason, I was thinking that she was gonna like pull up in her blouse and make him suck, you know, that's the way they call them.
And so Jason comes up behind her, stabs her in the back, stream of blood shoots right out from between her tits in 3D, presumably. So we get Tommy, Miles, and Olivia come across a trap door leading into Jason's tunnels. Angelo bumps into them, and seeing how fucked up he is, they tell him to just stay behind and keep walk. Miles snips a tripwire and comes face to face with Tim's rotting corpse. And they soon find the candlelit shrine surrounding Pamela's severed head. And Tommy sniffs out the candles, proposing to set explosives in the shrine and kill Jason with them when he returns. Makes sense? Yeah. And so meanwhile, Angelo has gone to a bathroom to splash water in his face, but Jason shows up. And so we get, from Angelo's perspective while he's high, we get a super slow motion scene of Jason swinging his machete, chopping through his fingers, and severing his head from the perspective of the severed head.
This would have been awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. Would have been a fucking technical bitch to pull off, but...
Yeah, it's reminding me, though, of one of the deaths from Midnight Train.
Oh, yeah. Tommy runs into Carl, asking if he knows how to set up a detonator, and Carl, who still has no idea what's going on, is like, oh yeah, I'll scavenge what you need.
Just automatically, like, oh yeah, I'll bomb this place.
And we go back to Jerry, who steps out of his cabin to see Jason dragging Christy's corpse by her hair. Before turning and looking at him, Jerry runs back inside, grabs a shotgun, firing at the first thing to come through the door, which turns out to be Carl. Instead of helping him, Jerry just uses Carl to barricade the cabin door and hobbles out the back on his crutches. And so we get this scene with Carl and Jason, we should probably read.
Oh, I also like that this is before or after Jerry has first seen Jason holding.
It's after.
I love that Jerry's reaction. Good gravy.
Yes. Carl, and him moving Carl is like reminding me of in Evil Dead 2, where Annie drags Jake from one end of the cabin to the other. Thwack! The machete stabs through the door, just missing Carl's head as he screams. Thwack! You do, Carl. On page 78.
Ah!
Carl falls over as crack. Jason crashes in, machete in hand. He quickly surveys the room, empty, sees Carl bleeding out on the floor, stunned at the sight of this mass killer.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Jason stands over Carl, pauses a moment, perhaps confused as to why this guy is already bleeding. A defiant look comes over Carl's face, a blood bubble forming on his lips as he utters his last defiant words.
Kill me quick so you can still catch that gimpy motherfucker.
Jason raises the machete high over his head and with both hands plunges the blade quickly into his chest. As he dies, Carl's finger extends slowly, pointing the way toward the open back door. And then we get this weird scene where he...
Jason Cocaine Bears it.
Yeah, a lot better than Cocaine Bear, though.
Yes.
And so Jerry manages to get inside his tiny electric car before Jason catches up. And it doesn't work, because apparently this is the only one Jason didn't pull wires out of. And Jason stabs, tackles, beats, and finally tips the car down a hill. And Jerry's broken leg gets severed in the process, and Jason beats him to death with it, spraying his Vegans Against Violence bumper sticker with blood.
He's grabbed the clip. Yeah, no head for heights.
Tommy returns to the tunnels, which have already been set with explosives by Miles and Olivia, and tells them that Carl is dead, so they have to change plans. We then cut to Tommy throwing a stick of dynamite down the trapdoor and running as the explosion sets off a chain reaction throughout the tunnels. They just go, like, trapdoors just go boom all over camp.
You know what would have been a cool if it had been down in there, and then we see, like, they have, like, that brief moment of relief thinking that he's dead, and then you see, like, one of the trapdoors just, like, burst open.
Yeah. And the three of them meet, hide in the mess hall, and Tommy says Jason is sure to come to them, pulling Pamela's head out of his backpack and setting it in a window with a flashlight highlighting it. He then tells them they have a chance, as Jason normally sticks to the shadows and kills one by one. But they're working together, and they lure him out using the intercom, Olivia pretending to be his mother. And they soon have the mess hall booby-trapped at every entrance, but Jason just crashes down from the roof through one of the solar panels. I'm pretty sure solar panels are not like skylights, but okay. But Olivia stabs Jason in the back and dives away, but gets caught in the hole meant for a knife trap, just barely avoiding the blade. So they're kind of end of Elm Streeting him. Elm Street wanting him.
Yeah, the whole booby trap thing.
And Jason kicks Tommy into the electric water trap at another door. Sucks to be Tommy. And Miles starts beating him with a baseball bat. Jason throws a knife, which Miles ducks. Olivia just manages to get free and block it before it hits her. Jason then cuts the baseball bat down to a stump, throws Miles into the kitchen as his machete has gotten stuck in the floor. Jason gets back up, fires his gun at Jason, giving him the back, shoulder, and chest, falling into the kitchen. He has Olivia grab a pair of cuffs from his backpack, but the extra bullets are missing because they've fallen out of his pocket onto the floor. And so Tommy gathers those. Miles cuffs Jason to the oven, and he goes to help Olivia, but Jason throws a barbecue fork at the back of his head, coming out of his eye socket, which is similar to how he kills the one cop in the remake.
Yeah, a little bit, but then again, it's the remake, so I haven't watched that in a while.
And because of the lighting, you can't really see it. And, you know, and begins to pull the oven away from the wall, allowing gas leak into the mess hall. Tommy and Olivia run for it, but Miles is still kicking, pulls out a flint trying to make a spark, and Jason drags the oven just far enough to reach his machete and chops himself free, presumably chopping the cuff and not his leg or his hand. And Miles makes a big enough spark, setting off a gas fire that reaches the last stick of dynamite and destroys the mess hall as Tommy and Olivia manage to get clear. So they really like burning down mess halls between this and Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah.
And so Tommy goes back into the wreckage to look for Jason's body, but he crawls out from under a piece of flaming wreckage, burned with a broken leg and a piece of his mask missing, and tries to strangle Olivia. That's something I've noticed about the New Line era movies, is that they really don't like showing Jason's face.
Yeah, except for Freddy versus
And even that's just a very little bit. And Jason as a kid in the flashback. But yeah, and so Tommy saves her, beating the hell out of Jason with a 2x4, while Jason grabs a fire axe that's been blown out of the building. And so they fight, with Tommy reminding Jason of his family, before Jason manages to slice Tommy in the stomach. And Olivia knocks Jason up a pipe blow to the head and decides they can't run but need to think. Callback. Tommy sees Jason's machete lying nearby and looks at the bell tower, forming a new plan. And so Olivia waits at the top of the tower while Tommy uses himself as bait, luring Jason to the tower, saying, "Hey, Jason, it's your birthday. It's the day your mother was killed. It's the day you're gonna die," which is a cool moment. Olivia starts to chop at the bell rope to crush Jason with it, but he stops at the last minute and hacks down the tower with the axe. The tower collapses and Jason is impaled on a piece of wood. Olivia is badly wounded, and Tommy is trapped with one arm under the bell, the machete nearby. Jason pulls himself off the spike, starts after the crawling Olivia, and Tommy can't get out from under the bell to help. And Jason is standing over Olivia about to attack when the machete pierces his chest, and blood begins to pour from the mask. And behind him is Tommy, with his hand severed at the wrist. You know, fucking Evil Dead style. And Tommy is too weak to finish Jason, so Olivia grabs the machete. And as she swings it at his neck, here's a really cool moment. Jason sees Pamela's head in the window, but to him it appears alive. And he then has a vision of his blood-spattered mother taking him down into the root cellar, telling him everything will be all right as his head is chopped off, and spins at the audience in 3D.
That's awesome.
That's actually a really cool scene. Like, shocking amount. And the whole root cellar thing sets up, kind of retroactively sets up why he has, you know, a thing for tunnels.
Yes.
And so sometime later, Olivia is waiting for a bus out of there. She shares a silent look with Tommy, his arm now in the sling. And as she rides away, she calls her mother, saying she's coming home. So she's facing her issues, character arc stuff. Tommy talks to a local cop, but he says he's fine because he's alive. It's not either of the two cops from the beginning, by the way. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm only missing a hand, and I'm not going to go to the hospital or anything.
How's he going to drive?
With one hand.
Joke that there's a specific reason why Ash Williams had there's a certain activity he had to learn to be left-handed
for. and so I was like, oh yeah, I'm planning to move on, and you know, I've got an uncle.
This one Easter egg.
I got an uncle in Springwood.
Jesus,
were they setting up a Freddy versus Jason remake?
Oh no! Or if this is like, yeah, if they're trying to do a shared universe thing. Their Platinum Dunes remakes.
Yeah.
It's already shared the same universe as Transformers.
Oh, yeah. And so that's when a school bus full of kids shows up for campus. Somebody forgot to make an important call. Oopsie. And so one kid notices Tommy's banded stump, and Tommy just winks at him. And we then see that Tommy still has Jason's head in his backpack, which he checks as he drives off to the tune of Don't Fear the Reaper, haha, Halloween reference, and it ends. And yeah, the subtitle that I didn't say was, the full title is Friday the 13th Camp Blood, The Death of Jason Voorhees. You see why I left that out? So yeah, overall, it's very good. It just has a couple of problems, and there aren't even really big ones.
Yeah, just expand upon the characters, fix some stuff around, draw it out a little more. It's been fine. I would have preferred this to the remake.
Yeah, and I think it's about as good as the Antosca script.
I'd say the Antosca script has better character development.
Yeah, that's true.
That one feels way more fleshed out in some of its ideas and theming, whereas this one's very much vomited out and fix it from there. But for considering some of the other like first drafts that we've read, this is pretty good, actually. It's a lot better than the two, like Halloween 666.
Oh, God. Yeah, but so overall, you know, it's a good one. It is better than the 666 drafts. Dear Christ.
This is a fun, straightforward script.
Yeah, it was good. And we talked about why it didn't happen because of that relationship with New Line and Paramount being very difficult.
And the fact that, like, Warner Brothers was taking over, at that point.
Yeah, and interestingly, apparently, according to Derek Mears, when the Interstellar deal was made in 2013, apparently they initially were talking about doing a sequel instead of like a reboot. But I have no idea how long that lasted, because I know they spent a year working on the found footage version, which I'd like to read whatever exists of that.
I don't know what existed of that, because I remember listening to like Nick Antosca talk about like that was a pitch that him and Rutger had come up with, and Paramount got back to him and said, okay, that guy who suggested the found footage idea, yeah, he's no longer here, so don't worry.
But yeah, I guess that covers it.
Yeah, happy Halloween, folks, beyond, and obviously this week, happy Friday the 13th.
And with that, bye.